Oh, Lasso. This afternoon, real simple. Let's return to the meditative cultivation of empathetic joy. And as you like it, there are so many different ways of doing it, right? Focusing on your own virtues, on the virtues of others. We've done a number of times. Let's have it free flow. And you'll just hear the wondrous sounds of silence from me. Okay? One session. So, not many questions, so we'll have certainly time for doing it live, speaking live here. I'll deal with the two short ones first. This is from Teresa. Can you talk a little bit more about not fusing mental events with the referent? What does the referent mean? Very good question. So, and it's, I hope I can give a very clear answer. And that is, let's just deal with the image of a loved one, any loved one you like, okay? Someone you hold dear. When you think of that person, an image comes to mind. So I'm doing it right now. Usually it's my mom comes up immediately, or other people also, but my mother often comes. And so there's an image, and it's in the space of the mind. And I know that I'm looking at an image. And it's an image I've called many times. It's pretty much just, often it's kind of the same slide. It's kind of my archetypal mom, you know? And it's often the same one, and it does bring kind of a warm feeling, but it's an image. But in the meantime, my mother is, in fact, I'm happy to say, still alive. She's in California, and she's almost certainly not looking like that right now, you know, because she's alive. She is someplace else. And so if I'm just settling the mind in its natural state, and this image or many other images, we have many images of our loved ones, but some image comes to mind, and my mind, my awareness remains, and in these three qualities, and again, I think, did I mention this just yesterday? I think I did. My awareness is right in the present moment. I am attending the space of the mind. And when that image is, let's say, if my mother comes up, I recognize it very quickly. It occurs, I recognize it. And then as I'm attending to it, if I remain utterly loose, relaxed, just being present with it, as if my awareness were space and this is simply an image that was just projected into space itself, like a rainbow is exactly an image projected into space. So when this image of my mother arises in the space of my mind, if it arises just like a rainbow, I attend to it, I'm utterly just relaxed with it, attending to it, and then it just fades out, then that's attending here and now to the event, the mental event that's arising in the space of the mind. Now, I have many associations with my mother, and I know that she's alive. And so if the same image or some image of my mother comes to mind, and then I think, oh, I wonder how she's doing. I haven't Skyped with her for a while. Maybe I should... she was reading a book that I sent her. I think she really liked it. I wonder if she's finished it yet. Maybe she's finished it. Maybe I should Skype her and see how did she like the book when she got to the end. I'm no longer here. I'm no longer now. I've used that image now has hooked me into thinking about her. There's nothing wrong about it, with thinking about one's mother, but it's not practicing settling the mind in its natural state. Okay, it's called having, if it's deliberate, it's thinking about one's mother. If it's not deliberate, it's having a distracting thought. So the simple point now, to use fewer words, is the mental event, the thought, the chit-chat, it can be a discursive thought. Where's the watermelon? This watermelon, why couldn't they buy seedless watermelon, you know? I have one more thing to gripe about, no granola and seed, you know. So the thought could come up, silly thoughts. And of course, I'm deliberately choosing silly thoughts. Why not seedless watermelon? And just that thought comes up and you just see it like out of thin air, like a voice from space emerges. Why not seedless watermelon? Don't that have it in Thailand? And then it just fades away. And you just note it, you know. You just, That's doing the practice. But then if I think about all the seedless watermelons I've enjoyed, not having to spit out all those little black seeds, you know, and I'm thinking maybe I could make a little very courteous, very gentle suggestion, seedless watermelons, you know. And so now I'm thinking about watermelons. Watermelons of the past, watermelons of the future, and watermelons that are being cut up right now, you know? So that's the difference. The watermelon is the referent. The image that comes up, or even, don't they have seedless watermelons? That phrase, that's just attending to an event in the present moment, okay? So really short answer, If you're attending to whatever's arising right now in the space of the mind, that's attending to the mental event. If your attention gets directed to what those thoughts or images are about, what they refer to, actual watermelons, actual mothers, and so forth and so on, then you've been snared, hooked in, and your attention now is gone there and then to the referent, the object, that which the image is about or refers to. Is that clear? Yeah? I want to be a big nod. Totally. But you can always follow up later. But was that clearer anyway? You don't know? Was it the English? Because I know sometimes I speak a bit quickly. All right. Why don't you listen to the because I think you listened. Aren't you one who listens again to the recordings after? Okay, why don't you listen again? But I want to make it very clear. So if you listen to that again, and if it's still not clear, write me another note, okay? But I will try once again, speaking more slowly. The referent, if the image is just the image of my mother, the referent is my mother. My mother is not an image. She's a human being, and she lives far away. This image is not a person, and this image just comes up in the space of my mind. Settling the mind means looking just at the image and not going to the referent, the actual person, the actual watermelon, and so forth. Okay? So the referent is always taking you someplace else. Attending to what's in the mind right now is here and is now. Okay? Good. If I can be clearer, let me know. I'll try. Okay? Good. So, and then from Anna Lorena. You explain how to recognize the sign in the practice of mindfulness breathing. But would you please explain the rest of the meditation process? I mean, how to work with the sign and how to recognize the countersign. How the air kasina looks like, aha, and how is the meditation with the kasina? Okay, here's interesting and very practical questions. So the first one, what's the rest of the practice? So again, a short review, you start with a preliminary sign, and sooner or later, you're going to want to focus on the sensations of the breath here at the apertures of the nostrils, and simply see that can you, and this is very important, that you can do so without pressure building up in the head. You don't want to make that a habit. Okay, if it comes up just once in a while, no problem. But if pressure starts coming back, coming up to the head, or tension, tightness, just come back to the belly. But when you can come up, and I'll use my word again, slender, not thick, not strong, not muscular, slender, like a straw of awareness, when you can very delicately focus just your mental awareness here and your whole face soft and your eyes utterly disengaged from the practice. You focus there on the preliminary sign. After some time, where you are focusing, there will arise a purely mental sign, and it will come repeatedly, and it will come in a very similar way. It will look pretty much identical or with minor variations. When it comes and it comes and it comes repeatedly, and right there where you are focusing, then you disengage your attention from the tactile sensations, which are the preliminary sign. You now focus on a purely mental sign, which then Tsongkhapa would approve of, because you won't achieve shamatha focusing on tactile sensations. You focus on the mental sign, and now I'll pick up with Anna's question. It's not so much a matter of working with it, as in if I'm working with somebody, if I'm working with Sanjay, maybe I'm her coach to teach her how to bake cakes. Well, I'll work with you on that one, Sanjay. You know, I'm such an expert on baking cakes, never having done it myself, but I've thought about it. Then I'd be working with you, but that means I'm doing something with you, you know, teaching you, we're conversing and so forth. Here, it's simple. We're not working with a sign. We're simply now, as I focus just right now on your face, I'm so right now focusing on Ana Lorena's face. I'm not working with Ana Lorena, nor am I working with the image of her face. I'm just attending to it single-pointedly. And so that's it. The practice becomes very simple. You can relate this now to many of the classic teachings on shamatha that you find foremost in the Tibetan tradition. And it's rooted in India. It was not a Tibetan fabrication. And that is deliberately generating mental image, like a Buddha Shakyamuni, generating it and then focusing single-pointedly on it. Then you can take all the teachings, like from Gyanlam Rinpoche's book, Calming the Mind. You can take all those teachings and you can apply them now. The difference is that this image that's coming is not one that's deliberately generated. It's one that's given to you. It comes spontaneously. Having come spontaneously, then you give it your attention and you sustain it just by that, by just focusing and sustaining the attention, and then just doing the practice as normal. But now your single-pointed object of mindfulness is just that acquired sign. As you do so, the medium, the subtle excitation will gradually subside. Medium and subtle, coarse, medium, subtle laxity will subside until eventually your senses implode, like all other shamatha practices, stages 7, 8, certainly by 9. Your senses withdraw into purely mental awareness, and at that point, like stage 8 or 9, your world, while you're in meditative equipoise, while in formal meditation, your world becomes very simple. And that is, there's an awareness, there's the image, and the space in which that image is occurring. That's pretty much it. Because everything else has just, you know, dissolved into mental awareness. All appearances now have just been simplified to this one. And so you simply take that as the single-pointed object of meditation, and you achieve stages however many, 6, 7, 8, 9, you get to the ninth stage. And then, when the counterpart sign arises, I think you will not need any words about, oh, is this it? And I need some instruction here. I'm not quite sure. There will be no uncertainty. I'm sure you recall the teachings that I've given, and you probably received them or read them in other texts, and that is this really quite, how do you say, exceptional, the descriptions of the quite exceptional experience of actually achieving shamatha. Because as you well know, it's not simply a little bit better. There is a discontinuity, a very significant shift in the prana, and these sensations, you've heard the teaching so many times, you're very familiar with them. But what you're experiencing there is a very clear shift in your whole prana system, in your mind, and it will be very memorable. You'll remember that day for the rest of your life. And as those are occurring, as we hear from the Tibetan side, the occurrence of suppleness, the pliancy, the buoyancy, the mental bliss, the physical bliss, and all of this, then it's at that, right in the midst of that very momentous experience, that the counterpart sign arises. And it will be as if the acquired sign breaks apart, and this counterpart sign shines through, or almost breaks through. And it will be memorable, and there will be no question about it. You won't need to confer with somebody, oh, is that it? If it were just a subtle sign emerging, then you might think, oh, that was just a very subtle image. But it comes together with a whole package. The goal is, ta-da, we're back live in Phuket. Okay, we're going, we're rolling. And would you like this back? Ilse is coming to get to swap technology. Oh, thank you, Mugila. Thank you. So, when you are practicing with the preliminary sign, because each of these kasinas, as I recall, at least all of those that I remember, they all have a preliminary sign, which is physical. So as I recall, you put up a screen. Let's imagine it's an 18-inch, or what should that be, 1.5 meter square, like a big piece of paper with a wooden frame. And then you punch a hole in it, maybe a circular hole in it, and then what you do is you find some area number one, you need a breeze. Now, nowadays, we could just turn on the fan. Before they had fans, then you had to kind of take the breeze where it came, unless you had somebody to go like this the whole time you were practicing shamatha. So what they would do, but these are monks, you know, when this was done first, these were monks living out in the jungle, so they didn't have anybody to go, you know, they didn't have servants. And so what you would do is you'd focus on, for example, the branches of a tree in the wind. And you'd be watching the movement, watching the back and forth movement as we see the breeze. You don't see the breeze, and who can see breeze, but you see the effects of the breeze. And that's what we say, oh, look, it's very breezy out there. How can you tell? Well, look at the branches, look at the leaves. I'm seeing the effects of the breeze. And so you attend to that, and then, as in all of these classic kasina practices, earth, water, fire, air, you'll take a Pali term, a Sanskrit term. I imagine it could also be Spanish or English. I don't think it really matters. These are not magical terms. But you would take a term, for example, wind or air, and you would mentally recite it as you're gazing now at the movement of the boughs of a tree, for example, moving in the breeze. You'll focus on those single-pointedly, your visual attention and your mental awareness. You'll just recite like a mantra. Let's say air, 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 or vata, vata, vata. And so you're immersing your mind in it verbally and mentally, focusing there, really not looking at the leaves per se, you're looking at the effects of the wind, and you're focusing single-pointedly on that. And then, after some time, there arises an acquired sign. Actually, if it's like the others, and again, I haven't memorized it, it's been some years now, I tended to focus on the earth element to talk about these other kasinas. But no, you don't go from there to the acquired sign. You would do that until you would have some image, and I'm going to guess here. It's, I think, an informed guess, but I'm not speaking with total confidence. And that is, you would gaze at that until you've so saturated your mind in these gently undulating boughs or branches of the tree that you really get it. You're becoming fixated on it in a deliberate fashion. So there's nothing obsessive about it, but you are becoming fixated, just totally fixed attention on it, and such that you're so immersing your mind in it that you can then go off into your quiet space. They would call it a kuti, your little hut. This is also vata. You go into your hut to the point that in your mind's eye, just quite easily, you would see an after image of swaying boughs. And you would just focus on that. You'd focus on that, the swaying boughs. But this is, again, it's a mental image, and then from that will come an acquired sign, okay? Because this is still, how do you say, it's really quite coarse. So that's rather crude, but what it leads to, finally, is the counterpart sign, okay? Since you chose the air kasina rather than the earth that I'm more familiar with and I'm more used to teaching, I'm a little bit uncertain on the details, but the point that I'm not uncertain is they both arrive to the counterpart sign of the air element, and you achieve shamatha, okay? If you'd like to get a definitive presentation, the most definitive, then look in the Visuddhimagga by Buddhaghosa. So are the sign and the counterpart sign free mental associations? They're not free, they come to you. The first one would be the image of the boughs of the tree, and then there will come something, how do you say, more subtle than that, that's purely mental, that will be dished up. If so, is the kasina something image for something, or is it an archetype where the kasina comes from? Yeah, when you get to the counterpart sign, these really are archetypal images, okay? But what I find quite interesting, is that according to Buddhaghosa, and I think he writes with enormous authority here, because he's simply relaying centuries and centuries of experience of previous yogis, that there is, when you get to the counterpart sign, which really does have an archetypal quality to it, and in the words of one very fine Sri Lanka Buddhist monk and contemplative, he calls it the conceptual quintessence, of earth, water, fire, and so forth. That sounds very much archetypal to me. What's interesting here is that it's not the same for everyone. It's not the same for everyone. Okay? I think in some, and I'm by no means a good scholar of Jungian psychology or philosophy, but I imagine there are some who use the words archetypes as if these are really in the collective unconscious and therefore there is one for everyone. That may be true, I don't know. But I do know in Buddhaghosa there is not just one. There's a certain range. And so it's not just any old thing. It's not just random. Nor is it just one. There's some variation there. And that seems to correspond to the individual who gained access to it. So it may be just a crude metaphor. If you walked in here afresh today as a newcomer, but we're old friends and I introduced you and I said, hello everybody, this is Anna. And let me tell you a little bit about Anna. And I introduce you briefly, and then you make some comments to everybody, okay? And then I asked, all right, everybody, please. And maybe we say, bye-bye, Anna, and Anna goes away. And I say, okay, everybody, please, tell me, what's your description? How would you describe Anna? Well, what we know is not going to happen is we're not going to get everybody writing exactly the same thing. I've introduced you, you've introduced yourself, but you're not going to find two people in the room that are going to write exactly the same thing. But nobody's going to say, oh, she's about 300 pounds, you know, about 300 pounds, and she's 3 feet tall, and, you know, you're not going to get really very different descriptions. They're going to be focusing around something, but you will be getting different people's perspectives on how they understood my words, how they perceived you visually, and how they understood you when you introduced yourself. So I think that might be not too bad an analogy. That it's not any old thing, but it's not everybody now just comes out like a computer program. Oh, this is Anna. Even though everybody heard the same thing, perceived the same thing pretty much, heard the same thing from me, heard the same thing from you, and perceived, there's the person, you know. We say, well, you perceive the same thing, but the way you perceived it, somewhat different. So I think that's what it's like for the archetypal images. Hola, so. Whenever I see Adelina, then I know it's going to be an epistle. Let me read it quietly and see if I can tease out. So it's about attaining shamatha. Okay. As described by the vital role of shamatha, Buddhist contemplative practice emphasizes striking attaining shamatha. It's not much done these days in Tibetan Buddhism. Okay. The great benefits, including psychological shift as described by you, the general like or is annoying and sometimes getting lost. Okay, here's the first question. Just commenting that while in so many classic texts, from the Theravada tradition, the Indian tradition, the Mahayana tradition, all schools of Tibetan Buddhism, all of them acknowledge the vital role of shamatha, it does seem that, and even though some people teach that you should practice it, you know, for a week here or a month there, that's not so uncommon. But there aren't that many teachers that I know of. In the Theravada tradition, maybe a bit more. In the Tibetan tradition, not so much. People say, well, okay, here are the teachings in shamatha, go off and achieve it and get back to me when you're finished. Not so much now. But one thing that I think we always have to bear in mind, even with that little preamble to your question, is that before 1959, hundreds of thousands of monks, 6,000 monasteries, must have been hundreds of thousands of nuns as well, lots of contemplatives, even though they've always been within them. And of course, there are a lot of lay yogis as well, women, men, always been quite a number. And fully acknowledging that the number of, let's say, within the monastic community, the number of monks and nuns who are really accomplished yogis, small percentage, always has been, small percentage. But when you have 100,000 monks, a small percentage is pretty good, you know? And for the nuns as well, and small percentage of the lay population, yeah, but when you have this being really the central feature of the whole culture, they had almost no secular literature, they had almost no secular art, they had folk songs, almost all their literature was Buddhist literature. I mean, there was history and other topics, language and so forth and so on. But when you have, and then the whole society, really, as a whole, the whole society thinking, supporting it in very practical ways. So how many, in 1959, how many Tibetans were there, or in greater, kind of the greater Tibetan Buddhist region of Ladakh and Sikkim, Bhutan, and so forth, Lahul. So how many had achieved shamatha at that time? There could have been scores of them, there could have been hundreds of them, because they had the environment. They had the environment. They had benefactors. If you were a really serious yogi, you would find a benefactor. That was hardly in question. And you'd find some place that somebody would be, oh, you want to meditate 10, 12, 14 hours a day? Gosh, people would really want to support you. I never heard of anybody in Tibet said, oh, I really wanted to meditate, but nobody wanted to support me. I had to get a job. Never heard of that. And so, conducive environment, you've got support, you have plenty of instructors around. And so the environment was really there. If you really wanted to do it, you could. With the invasion, I mean, even Genchama Wondu, one of my beloved teachers, and the yogi's yogi, oh, incredible yogi, he was living on meditation pills, the Medochulen, the flower essence pills. He was living on these. After doing about 10, 15 years of his formal monastic training, he didn't care about getting the degree, becoming a geshe. So after he learned the Madhyamaka, the Prajnaparamita, and the Pramana, Buddhist epistemology, he said, I'm out of here. And he went up and he trained under the guidance of Tehor Gyopen Rinpoche. Incredible yogi, extraordinary yogi. This was Milarepa style. These were all just Milarepa style. And so he went up there, he joined this hermetic community. And before long, he mastered the ability of living just on these little flower essence pills, three little pills. And then after you lose a bit of weight, you stabilize, you can simply continue for months. He was cruising. He was just cruising. And then March 10th, 1959 happened. And he thought, and he recognized, if I stay here, it's only going to be a matter of time. The army's going to come up, and they're going to capture me and probably put me in jail. So then he had to flee. Okay? Well, he never found as conducive a circumstance in India as he had there. Never. So when we say it's rare, before and after is an enormous difference, I think. And now just conducive circumstances. When you're refugees living in a very, very different country from your own, 14,000 feet, 2,000 feet, maybe 1,000 feet, very cool and dry, very hot and humid. Big difference. And shamatha is one of those practices. It's really almost in a class by itself. It's not really, but it almost feels like it. That when you're doing shamatha and you really want to achieve it, you almost want to be in an incubator. Really, you want a very special environment. You don't need that for so many other practices, but for this, when you really want it, and all of those outer, I don't need to give you the list, but you remember them. You really need those. And if you don't have them, then Atisha says you can meditate for what, 1,000 years and never achieve it, right? Well, the environment is really, really rare now. You have to create them. So Klaus has created one. But you notice this type of environment doesn't grow on trees, right? So that's a very important preamble to all of this. So the described by, yeah, and when you speak of the great benefits of access concentration described by me, I would have to say I'm simply irrelevant here. I'm like a telephone wire, you know. So you don't say, oh, the telephone wire delivered this message. The message is coming from centuries and centuries of yogis, including some very recent ones and contemporary ones from whom I've had instruction. But I really have nothing to add. Yeah. So narrated by me. Are they generally recognized? Yes. They're generally recognized by people who have studied sufficiently. There are people who... I mean, there are a lot of monks who never study very well. To do just the preliminary practices, you may never really learn about shamatha. And so it does take, you have to study some, at least get a really good solid Lam Rim text, or Words of My Precious Teacher, or the Lam De, or Jewel Ornament Liberation. And there are superb texts in all four schools of Tibetan Buddhism that will give you a definitive, precise, accurate presentation of the nature of shamatha, the benefits of shamatha. They're not hard to find. Not everybody studies them. And frankly, in some traditions, it seems like, especially nowadays, when it seems like even the Tibetans are in a hurry. You know, a lot of them seem like they're really in a hurry, especially when they're teaching Dharma to the Western people. See, if they're teaching Dharma to Tibetans, like in Namdur Ling, the great Nyingma monastery in the south of India, well, the monks are coming in there, they're expecting to spend 15 years. You know, if they're serious, if they're going for the whole Kempo training, they've come to school. They've come to school. And so you expect they're going to be there for 15 years. Well, there won't come a single monk out of there. I can't imagine. I've not received their curriculum. But I think it would be almost impossible to imagine they could go through 15 years of solid, really good Sutrayana and Vajrayana and Dzogchen training and not know the significance of shamatha. I don't know how they could miss that. But a lot of Nyingma practitioners don't get the Kempo training. They may just get a little bit of training, a bit of oral transmission here, a text here, an empowerment there, do a three-year retreat here, and then, okay, I'm ready to teach. And they may have never really gotten the message about, you know, the indispensability of shamatha and its relationship to vipassana and so forth. They may have never heard it. And I have no particular person in mind. I'm not picking on people. But there are great scholars and there are people who have, you know, just a little bit of this and a bit of that. And that does happen a lot in the West from all traditions because we're in a situation now in the West and its modernity where lamas, often very qualified, will come to a Dharma center and they're coming for a weekend. And they'll come a year later and they'll come for a weekend. You know, and then another lama come for the week, you know, a month later come for a weekend. And the first Lama didn't know that the second Lama was coming, and the second Lama doesn't know who the third one is, and the fourth one doesn't know who the first three, you know. And there are a lot of centers like this, in which case it may just fall through the cracks. Because the shamatha is something that you get when you get a systematic training from the ground up. And if you don't get that, you may miss it. And that means really solid sutrayana. And not everybody gets it. Not everybody gets it. And if you don't get it, you may just think, well, why are you messing around with shamatha? That's hinayana. That's hinayana stuff. We're vajrayana practitioners. What are you messing with that stupid stuff? Stupid shamatha. Why don't you focus on stage regeneration? This is really profound. Why are you messing around with stage regeneration? Go for tumo. Go for chi. Now that's the real fast way. Go for chi. Get your drum. Make sure you get your drum. And now let's go for chi. Oh, let's go for, you know, and why are you messing with a drum? Dude, dzogchen. You know, what do you need a drum for? Just dzogchen. And let's all become marmots together. You know? So there's a lot of variety. But I do yearn for the good old days in Tibet before the occupation. So as I understand, access concentration can be seen as the great starting transit point towards jhanas. That's indisputably true. Towards vipassana, it really is. I mean, there was Bhikkhu Bodhi told me, it was a 13th century, something like that, 13th century Burmese sub-commentator who initiated a notion that's now become just very, very common, very widespread in the contemporary Vipassana tradition of momentary samadhi. Momentary samadhi. The Buddha never taught it. Never even came up. It came up, what would that be, 500 plus 13, something like 1800 years after the Buddha? When somebody came up with this notion of momentary samadhi, that was sufficient, that you didn't need access, you didn't need full jhana. There's an outstanding scholar. This has been debated a lot. I've looked at the debates, and to my mind, his ethnicity is, he's a Yugoslavian. He's passed away, but a monk, Kamenda Tera. I think he did superb scholarship on this point, and he showed that it was a misunderstanding. That momentary samadhi is not a substitute for the first jhana. Never was, and it's simply a mistake. And what he does, this 13th century sub-commentator, so I'm thinking scholastic. He took a reference to this in Buddhaghosa, in the Visuddhimagga. There is a reference to momentary concentration. And he took it completely out of context. What Kamenda Tera, I think, very compellingly argues is that the reference to momentary samadhi by Buddhaghosa is in the context of assuming you've already achieved at least one jhana, and maybe all four. It's way, way into the text. It's not way at the beginning when you're trying to achieve access. It's way like 300, 400, 500 pages later, deep. I think it's in the wisdom section, the vipassana section. And that's assuming that you've already achieved shamatha. So I think Kamenda, obviously when I say it, this doesn't make it true. But I read, I just thought Kamenda Tera gave a very, very good case for it. And I have the chronicles of the whole debate that went on. I have one paper that he wrote about this that I think is very good. And then his little book, The Way of Buddhist Meditation, outstanding scholarship, really good, all absolutely based in the Nikayas, the Pali Canon. And he describes the indispensability of the first jhana and then goes into Vipassana. It's just outstanding scholarship. And that's available on the, on the shamatha.org website. That's one that we've created for the International Shamatha Project. I was given that, a nice PDF, very, very legible PDF file, The Way of Buddhist Meditation. And the author has passed away, and I got kind of an informal permission, as long as I'm not charging for it, this is Dharma, make it freely available. And the last thing I'd ever dream of be charging. So it's available online, nice PDF file, download it for free, and then you can judge for yourself. I have his article, just about this misunderstanding about momentary samadhi. And then his whole book, nice, but it's a nice short book, very readable, very clear. And they're both online at shamatha.org. And then, maybe I'm mistaken. But then anybody who reads that can draw their own conclusion. Okay? Besides that, in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, it's perfectly clear. This whole notion of momentary samadhi being sufficient never even came up. So there was one delusion that didn't need to be dispelled because it was not created in the first place. So yes, the great strength, one of the great mighty strengths of the Buddha's contemplative revolution in India was the fusion of samatha vipassana. That's it. I mean, that's the core. That's the, as science has the scientific method that you can distill in a few lines, this is the Buddhist scientific method. It's the union of samatha vipassana. And if you throw out the samatha, you don't have the method. If you throw out the vipassana, you don't have the method. If you simply have samatha and then you also have vipassana, you don't have the method. It's the union of the two. And that is just universal. There we go. So for that, yes. And there is, as I mentioned before, in terms of the bodhisattva path, there is very high-level scholarly discussion about whether it's absolutely indispensable to have access to the first jhana, to develop bodhicitta so that it arises spontaneously and effortlessly. It's a scholar's debate at a very high and subtle level. And my impression is they all agree you've got to have very good samadhi. The notion of having a wandering mind and developing some, you know, becoming a bodhisattva with a mind that's dysfunctional doesn't really make much sense. So do you say that with access concentration, bodhisattva actions can be 2,000-fold as skillful, powerful than without? Of course, I don't say anything at all. What do I know? I speak with zero authority. But what Atisha says, and I think he does speak with enormous authority, recognized by his peers. It's not just I like Atisha, but he was renowned in India. He is tremendously renowned. And in Tibet, gosh, who is more loved than Atisha, you know? Totally beyond all sects also. Sects. Not a gender issue. And he said in his Bodhipada Praditam, Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment, that, and I'll paraphrase it very closely, you've heard it before though, that you can accumulate more merit in one day if you've achieved extrasensory perception than you can in 100 lifetimes without them. And then the next verse says, and how do you achieve these extrasensory perceptions? Shamatha. So there it is. So one day versus 100 lifetimes. I did the rough math, you know, thumbnail math. It's about 3 million times. And of course, he didn't mean exactly 3 million, I think. 2,999,000. give or take one or two. So what he's referring to is just the sheer potency, the efficacy of it, right? With a mind that is that supple. And this is described, Tsongkhapa, I think, is the clearest I've ever seen, of just describing the enormous utility. I know that's a very utilitarian word, but just the marvel of having a body-mind, is actually body-mind, that is unprecedentedly imbued with what is called in Tibetan Xinjiang, or Sanskrit Prashrapta, suppleness, buoyancy, lightness, malleability, that your just mind is so ready to be do whatever you wish to do. In the nighttime, dream yoga, daytime, vipassana, bodhicitta, whatever you want to do, it just seems like there's no comparison. And it's not just that you can, you know, sit in meditation for 4 hours or 11 hours or this or that. It's that this radical shift takes place in the prana system. It's just like, just revamping. It's almost like I've thought of this before. We have these extreme makeovers. Remember extreme makeovers? And maybe they crack the bones in your face and give you plastic surgery all over the place and suck fat out of your parts. And so you look radically different afterwards. So extreme makeover, and that's in a materialistic society, that's exactly what you'd expect. I feel a whole other person. Look at my butt. You know? Look at the lack of wrinkles on my face. Of course, I can't smile anymore, but... But I sure do feel made over. Oh, yes, isn't it wonderful? Okay, we have the outsert, the materialistic extreme makeover, and then we have the contemplative extreme makeover. Shamatha is the extreme makeover from within. Okay. Available from your neighborhood retreat center. Okay. What does this mean for the bodhisattva path and so forth? Well, is there much less attaining shamatha than before? Is there so much less attaining shamatha? What it does mean is clearly is that this is just going to enormously empower your whole spiritual practice. Both wings, the compassion side, the wisdom side, everything. And your ability to be of service, of practical service to others. He actually says, he prefaces this, that if you, it's raising the bar very high. He says, if you don't have, and I've referred to this before, but if you don't have these modes of extrasensory perception, in other words, really tapping into the profound inner resources of mental awareness, right? If you don't have those, he said, you can't, he really raises the bar high, he says, you can't really work for the benefit of sentient beings. Well, clearly, he's no fool. You know, if you give a monk a bowl of rice, you've just served sentient beings, and you don't need samadhi for that, right? So he's no fool. So you have to know this is a brilliant man. I think that's not blind faith, that's just common sense. He must have been brilliant. And by all the accounts of him, extraordinary bodhisattva, and he'd achieved samadhi, and he displayed paranormal abilities. And he was a great scholar. He was just an all-around, he was kind of like what Galileo was for science, Atisha was for Buddha Dharma. He was the whole package, everything. Archetypal, quintessential. I just love him. You know, everything about him. Love Atisha. And what was I getting at there? So the man is, you know, he's not naive. He's not foolish. And I think what he's really getting at is, for the good of sentient beings, what's he talking about? Do you think he's talking about hedonic well-being or genuine happiness? Genuine happiness, just getting the engine running or just opening up the whole freeway of moving along the path of genuine happiness without blockage. Obviously. You're not talking about hedonic. We can all help all kinds of sentient beings in terms of hedonic well-being, and that's a wonderful thing. But it does take some quite exceptional skill to be able to, when a person walks into the room and is speaking, maybe they're coming for guidance, it does take some exceptional skill to be aware who's come into the room. And as you listen, as you attend, to really get a really good sense, what are the problems this person brings? What are the strengths? What are the proclivities? Where could the dangers lie among this wide array of practices? Which one might be the most beneficial? And then as the person progresses, you don't just teach them for 8 weeks. You teach them for 8 years. Or you teach them for the rest of their life. You are their mentor until they're Buddha or until they pass away, whichever comes first. Well, to be a really gifted spiritual mentor of that sort, that you're there for them every step of the way. If they achieve shamatha, good. You're there for them waiting, good. Now we're ready to go here. And then they, you know, achieve, gain deep insight through vipassana practice. You're there for them, good. You come there. This is called, there's a beautiful term for it in Tibetan. It's called nyongti. This is worth a little digression. Yeah, and we, 540, yeah, 542, good. Is it worth a little digression? And then there's, ti means to give guidance, to give guidance. It can also just mean giving instruction, but it really means to guide. More than just giving an explanation. Deshe gyapa, that's to give an explanation. But ti gyapa, that's to give guidance. And the three modes of giving a ti, or guidance. The first is called shet ti, shet ti. And shet means to explain. So it's explanatory guidance. It's explanatory guidance. And most of the public teachings that are given in the modern world, nowadays, most of the public teachings given are shit tea. And this is where, when it's being done correctly, a person who knows material well, if an oral transmission was needed, has it. If empowerment was needed, has it. This person will come to a Dharma center, a monastery, what have you. There will be, the word will get out. And such as such, let's say it's His Holiness Dalai Lama, is coming to Saranat, and he's going to teach the Bhavana Krama by Kamala Shila. Okay? I attended his teachings on that topic about a year and a half ago. And so it was widely broadcasted, 5,000 people showed up. I had the good fortune to be able to be there. And over a course of relatively few days, His Holiness gave a great deal of teaching in a very short time. And he also taught another text as well, but that was one of the texts he taught. And then it's over. I think he gave an initiation as well, but then it's over. And then the 5,000 people scuttle back to their monasteries, their homes, and so forth and so on. And then it's at each individual's discretion whether they take those teachings, how much they... Now, of course, now we have recording devices, which is fantastic. But earlier, you would just be listening very intently. If you were literate, could really write well, then you might take notes. But having received just the explanatory guidance, then you come home, and then you may spend weeks, months, or years practicing those teachings that you got in a short period. Right? And so that's a shetti. And especially when you go home, if there's someone there, a monk, a lama, a knowledgeable spiritual friend, that now you receive the transmission, the teaching from His Holiness, And now this, and then as you're practicing it, really applying this in daily practice, you have somebody to consult. His Holiness said this, the text said this, I'm confused, I don't get this. And then you have somebody to consult, then this really works out well. And that was done for centuries in Tibet. That's one way. So it's not gradual, it's all of a sudden, it's heavy download, and then the Lama's gone, because he's gone someplace else to give teachings elsewhere, or he's head of state, and he's, you know, governing the country. So that's one. The second one is Nyamti. Nyamti, and Nyam means together with, literally even. And this is where, for example, a teacher, Lama, Guru, whoever, will be giving teachings, let's say on, well, let's say Lamrim. The Lamrim. So stages, these are all, mostly, not all, discursive meditations. And so you start, let's say, with reflections on a precious human rebirth. And you come to the Lama and say, I would like to receive Lamrim. In fact, I know somebody who did this. It was really wonderful, who received this. It wasn't only Nyamtit, it was the highest level of teaching. And that was, it was an extraordinary man, Losan Tenzin. Losan Tenzin, it's almost like John Smith in Tibetan. But it's Losan Tenzin was his name. And he had a very interesting life. It would be interesting to go to a tangent, but I won't. But he, well into life, I think he was 45, 48 years old, he developed this very strong renunciation that he just absolutely wanted to devote the rest of his life to Dharma. And it was 100%. He went to the senior tutor of the Dalai Lama and said, please teach me Lamrim. He's a peasant. He's not a Rinpoche. He did become a monk. But he's a peasant, you know. But he developed this pure motivation. And the senior tutor said, I will teach you. And that's pretty choice. And he taught him Lamrim, and he taught it piece by piece. He said, okay, here are the teachings on the precious human birth. Go off and meditate. He gave it to him, complete. Maybe he spent some days on it. Okay, now go and meditate. And then he gained realization. He got it. It turned his mind. I really get it. It was like water that super saturates a sponge. I got it. I'm full of it. I'm just full of these teachings now. Saturated my mind. Then good, come back. Now I'll give you the teachings on death and impermanence. And then go away. I'll see you when you get it. Then come back. So it's more like teaspoon. Rather than the fire hydrant, you get a whole lot at once, and then you hopefully it assimilates, or it doesn't. People go home and they say, oh, I received these teachings, put it back, and I know them. They're in my library. You know, then the book may be getting lightened faster than the person that does. But this is the teaspoon approach, like feeding a spoon feeding a baby. You don't give the next spoon until they swallowed. That's nyam. That's nyam tea. Now, what Losan Tenzin had the good fortune to receive was not only spoonful by spoonful, but the highest level of teaching, the highest level, the optimal mode of guidance is called nyongti, and this is experiential guidance. And this certainly is what Losan Tenzin received. It wasn't simply that the Lama taught him piece by piece, but he would give him the teachings, and then Losan Tenzin would come in and report. And then Yongzhen Ling Rinpoche, the senior tutor, would listen to him, knowing, having this experience, knowing what it's like to totally get it himself, and he would listen until he saw, yeah, you got it. You really got it. Okay, next. Now, that's for Lamrim. Well, let's imagine Shamatha. Imagine you're receiving a nyongti, so a nyamti, so the shetti, the first word, here's all the teachings of Shamatha. Okay, good luck. And then you take them home and you try to practice. The nyamti would be, okay, here are the teachings just around the stage one and stage two, and here's the method. Go off and practice, but I'm not going to talk about stage three, four, and so all of that business until you clearly have stabilized at stage two, and then I'll give you the next bit. And the nyongtit teacher would teach that out of his or her own experience, knowing what it's like to actually really nail the second stage, and then listening, watching, attending, okay, you've got it. Knowing from his own experience, strong resonance, yeah, I know I have it, you've got it. Teach, and then right on through shamatha, and then right on through vipassana and so forth and so on. So there are texts, I think the one that's closest to my heart, and it's just a personal thing, is this Vajra Essence, this text, this mind treasure of Dujum Lingpa. It's the whole path. There's a brief reference to preliminaries, then it's shamatha, it's vipassana, it's stage of generation, stage of completion, which are optional, but very, very important if one is drawn to them, and then tekchut and turtkau, and then rainbow body. And the text says you don't really need to look anywhere outside this text. If you want to achieve enlightenment in one lifetime, everything you need to know is here. Okay? Well, it's possible to receive that all in a bunch. Just here's the text, and Go off and practice the whole text. You just receive the whole path to enlightenment. That would be the Shetti. A person who doesn't necessarily have the experience of all the stages, but has good understanding. Really clear, accurate understanding, and some taste. I mean, if the person's not practicing at all, then what's the point? That means you don't even believe in it, really. But a person may not have realization on all the stages, but has clear understanding, and maybe some taste. Then that person can give the nyamtit, the gradual, that would be the spoonful approach, the gradual guidance. And that it's happened many times in the history of Buddha Dharma, and I'm sure other traditions as well, that a guy that is competent, who is a clean nozzle on the end of the hose, can lead people to higher states of realization than the teacher himself has. It's happened since the time of the Buddha. That is, none of Buddha's disciples achieved realization higher than his. But from very early days, there are accounts of the teacher not being arhat and leading a disciple to arhatship. I know one particular story that leaps to mind. So that's happened many times. And that's where the power of the lineage comes through. If you're just teaching on the basis of your own knowledge, your own experience, then that's it. But if you're clearly, accurately transmitting wisdom beyond your own, you may lead people far beyond your own realization. But the optimal, of course, is that a person teaching the Vajra essence has already achieved, you know, the highest stages of the direct crossing over, and then just gives the text piece by piece, experience by experience. And I think that's how Dujom Lingpa was able to lead 13 people to Rainbow Body, and they say 1,000 achieved Vidyadhara. Because he was giving it straight from experience. Okay? So is access, concentration in Theravada next on the way to jhana? Yeah, it's right next to it. And vipassana? Also seen as really important by itself in society. Well, over the last, it's about 50 years, maybe 60 years, not much before then, there's what I would call, and with respect, because it's helped many, many people, hundreds of thousands of people, what I would call, with respect, the modern Vipassana movement. And it comes largely out of Burma. And then it spread there, I think Malcolm knows better than I, independent of the Burmese movements, I have a question for you, Malcolm. Achan Mun, was he come, Achan Mun, Mun that you mentioned? Chamang? Chamang. The one that you mentioned to me that you trained with, was he getting his lineage from Burma, or was it right out of Thailand itself? Do you know? Achan Man. Achan Man. At the turn of the century, uh-huh.
And he, I think he died about 1949.
But he had a series of teachers that were very profound teachers. Yeah. And were they simply from his own realization? Did he have...
Yes, he was famous for that. He didn't study. He studied himself.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't come from Burma. He came from his own...
Yeah. But in other words, he was not really then passing on a lineage from his teacher. He learned this and that teacher. I'm not just saying that he was just a lone ranger, but his teaching was more coming from his own realization rather than passing on a lineage. Is that correct? Yeah, and he's simply native Thai, not from the Burmese tradition as such. Good, that's helpful, thank you. There is a word for that in Tibetan tradition, it's called Rangjung. Rangjung, it means self-arisen. And there are yogis, but this occurs everywhere. It's occurred in the Christian tradition. My understanding is Jacob Boehme was very much like that. He was actually Protestant, but extraordinary contemplative, but much more Rangjung, self-arisen. But coming back briefly to this movement coming out of Burma, and as far as I know, my knowledge is limited. But there's Goenka and his teacher Ubha Khin, so there's one lineage, and quite a separate lineage is Mahasi Sayadaw. These two individuals around the mid 20th century, they really got something rolling, and what they're both emphasizing overwhelmingly is vipassana, 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 vipassana. Both overwhelmingly, do not emphasize shamatha, just put it that way. Not to say that they necessarily overlook entirely, but must achieve first jhana, that's really important here, go into meditation for 1 year retreat, 2 year retreat, it's not there. And so that's what's really dominant, and that is spread, it's certainly come here to Thailand, it's definitely come to Sri Lanka, and there's a kind of a marginal emphasis on shamatha. And in the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition, the rationale for this is that this momentary samadhi is sufficient. It's debated among very, very top, you know, Theravada scholars themselves. I have my opinion, that's all it is. So there we are. But Samatha, Buddhadasa emphasized Samatha more. I'm trying to think, this contemporary, I've actually met him. Pa Auk Sayadaw, he emphasizes. It's not clear to me, and I'm just expressing my ignorance, it's just my ignorance. It's not clear to me that when he teaches the first jhana, that the bar is at the same level as Buddhaghosa. When he says, when you achieve the actual state of the first jhana, you can maintain an uninterrupted meditation for 24 hours. That's, I think, where the bar should be. That's the legitimate, the authentic bar. That's it. Because he writes with enormous authority. He wouldn't make up something like that. So it's just not clear to me how many people, even in the Theravada world, are recognized that's where the bar is. And what I have found, especially now in the West, is people speaking, referring to jhanas, they say practicing jhanas, achieving jhanas. The most one that I think is the silliest, frankly, is come for a jhana weekend and pick up one or two. And to my mind, I don't think people are being deliberately deceitful. They just haven't studied enough, you know. And that happens a lot. I know one person, I'll leave this one vague, but there was one Burmese teacher that went to California and he led a one-month retreat. And he said, and this was a Burmese teacher, said, oh, or I heard through the grapevine, oh, one or two students achieved the first jhana, but then they lost it. It's almost like finding their wallet and losing it, you know. It's like, so I don't take it very seriously. Because I do take so seriously the words of the Buddha, and for the Theravada tradition, the Buddha and Buddhaghosa, and then some exceptional scholars and contemplatives after that, such as my own teacher, Abhalanguddha Anandamaitreya. Once again, this is not an opinion. He was absolutely exceptional, and he was recognized as such throughout all of, I think, Theravada world. He was really exceptional. And when I asked him, when I was training with him under his personal guidance, I asked him, how many people do you think right now, and this was in 1981, how many people do you think right now in Sri Lanka, which then had a population of 14 million people, how many people, and there are thousands and thousands of monks and many, many retreat centers, almost all of them Vipassana retreat centers, how many monks do you think right now have achieved first jhana in Sri Lanka? He said, you can count them on the fingers of one hand. And that's because with the really wonderful qualities of Vipassana being so strongly emphasized and getting a lot of people to meditate who are otherwise not meditating, even monks and nuns not meditating and now meditating. That's a good thing. But when there's so much emphasis on the Vipassana and then none on the Samatha, or very little, then it's no wonder that not many people achieve it. And I think as Buddhaghosa spoke with tremendous authority about the Theravada tradition, I think Balangoda Anandamaitreya could speak with a lot of authority about his own home country. He was maybe the senior most monk in the whole country. If he wasn't the senior, he was among the top handful. So there we go. And how much society? Well, most Buddhists aren't all that knowledgeable, any more than that many Christians are really, really know their scriptures and the commentaries and so forth. I mean, most people, they're busy with other things. So no, I don't think the society as a whole, if you just went to knock on somebody's door, what do you think? Is the first jhana really essential? Say, jhana, is that, who's jhana? Have I met him? And now that I'm offering intensive shamatha courses and creating shamatha access, etc., observatory here in Thailand, have you had comments on this from Theravada monks and nuns? I've not met one this time since I've been here, but I do know some and very happy. I mean, one of the Theravada monks that I know and have enormous respect for. He's actually from Nepal, that is born in Nepal, but he's utterly fluent in Thai, outstanding scholar. His name is Pra Anil Sakya, or Sakya, Anil Sakya. And he lives in Bangkok. Right now he's in Oxford, England. He's very, very good. He's outstanding. And I'm sure there are many, many others. But I've only moved here, and I just moved right into our Phuket International Academy. So I'm looking forward as the months go by and spending more time here. But if people know that when I'm teaching Anapanasati, that I'm doing my flat-out best to teach it in accordance with the words of the Buddha and the great commentary by Buddhaghosa, I don't think they'd have any reason to object. And when they know also that the settling of the mind is utterly in accordance with, nothing incompatible with the whole Pali canon of the Theravada tradition, there would be no reason for objection. And the awareness of awareness looks to me identical to the Vijnana Kasina, which is the teachings of the Buddha again. So all that I've heard thus far, and actually the staff here, Nick could probably tell more, and the other staff here at the PIA, of course, they've had a lot of interaction with the surrounding community. And from what I hear, very positive. Very positive, yeah. So, when I speak of a revolution, it's not a revolution against Buddhism. But it is, I would love to see a renaissance. A renaissance. That we just come back in the spirit of all great renaissances, coming back to the core, back to the ground, and not simply riding the wave of tradition, honoring the tradition, assimilating for the tradition, but making sure that we're really in touch with the core teachings, and that I have a great passion for that, and trying to honor them, and yet bring them utterly into the 21st century. So that's my aspiration. How well I succeed, I think that's just student by student. For some students, I probably fail abysmally. Some mediocre, some maybe not so bad. But that's for the students to decide, not for me. I'll just do my best. That's all. So, it's 6 o'clock. So we wound up because I went on that one. But hopefully that was helpful. I can say I did my best for what that was worth. So, enjoy, and I'll see you tomorrow morning.